This is Lewis Lapham with The World in Time. My guest is the historian Edward Dulnick, speaking with us today about the invention of modern science in 17th century Europe. Your new book, Edward, comes with the title The Clockwork Universe, a vision of the natural world as a perfect machine rising at a moment in history when what could be seen of the natural world was far from perfect and for the most part chaotic. Maybe you can begin by describing the scene in London in 1660, the year that brought with it the death of Oliver Cromwell and the birth of the Royal Society.
1660 in London is a time when it seems that the world is falling apart. You've got a plague in Europe. It's threatening to jump the channel to England. If it does, there's nothing you can do except cower and hope that it doesn't hit you. The 1660s are a time of fear and trembling in England. Plague does come. Then it's followed by the Great Fire. In the meantime, the skies are filled with comets. Comets are disasters, everybody knows, like lightning bolts, except longer lasting. People are panicked that the end of the world is nigh. I think, in fact, it turned out to be the beginning of the modern world, but no one at the time dared hope such a thing.
And what did the streets of London look like?
Astonishingly dangerous and dirty by our standards, by any standards, in fact. There's giant piles of human waste blocking your way. The butchers are doing their best to add to the muck, throwing in all kinds of carcasses. It's dangerous. It's dark nearly all the time. If you go out, you're liable to be knocked over the head. Then the police won't be around for centuries. It's a dangerous, superstitious, crime-ridden, disease-ridden era.
And nobody knows much about medicine.
Less than nothing. This is a dangerous time. If you fall into the hands of a doctor, you're worse off than if you had managed to stay away. This is one of the few instances, in fact, in which it's worse to be rich than to be poor, because the rich fall into the hands of doctors, whereas the poor can't afford them, and the doctor's ministrations are nearly always worse than if you were simply left alone.
What, then, is the Royal Society that comes into being in this year?
The Royal Society is a grab bag collection of mad geniuses and eccentrics. Often the genius and the eccentric are the same person, who have taken it in their heads that rather than look in libraries to find out the answers to any number of questions about how the world works, they're going to carry out experiments and look for themselves. And that idea that we take to be common sense, that you ought to look for yourself, in their day was taken as not only not common sense, but bizarre. What you were meant to do if you needed to find something out was to trust to the experts. That's what it meant to be a scholar, to run to the library and to see what authorities had to say. And now, for the first time, someone was saying that was actually a misguided notion. You ought to look for yourself. And that was a radical suggestion.
You say also that they are not like us. I mean, the mistake is to think that somehow the modern world appears out of nowhere in the middle of the 17th century. But these men think differently than we do.
The temptation is to think that the scientists whose names we know, Newton, Galileo, Kepler, these kind of people, are essentially time travelers, that they're like us, except that they wore wigs and funny clothes, and they lived a long time ago. But just as you say, they weren't like us. What they took for granted about why their work was important or what they might hope to find was completely different from what we had in mind. What they thought they were doing, Newton especially, was paying homage to God by investigating his handiwork.
Give us the names of a few of the prominent people in the Royal Society in the 1660s and 70s. You mentioned a number of them. They're all colorful characters. Give us a brief description.
One of the leading figures is Robert Hooke, who to his admirers was the Leonardo of London, this brilliant inventor, a small, twisted, bad-tempered, competitive man. You had only to mention an idea, any idea virtually at all, to hear that Hooke had thought of it first, feuding with everybody, Newton most of all. But Hooke was a terrific showman. He had figured out a way you could pump the air out of a bell jar. And this was tremendously exciting. You could put mice and chickens and snakes inside the spell jar and pump out the air and watched what happened. And all the men of the Royal Society, who in many ways were essentially a bunch of rowdy Cub Scouts, would gather round to see if the critter would die. And then at one point, Hooke figured out a way to make a giant bell jar so big that he could climb in himself. And he climbed inside, and he gave the signal to pump out the air. The thing malfunctioned before he could kill himself, but he did manage to render himself dizzy and deaf, which was the next best thing.
So this is a world of marvels. I mean, it's an age of discovery, and people are inclined to believe almost anything.
nearly anything was possible. There are legitimate, astonishing discoveries being made. There are new continents being discovered. And now, with technology coming along, with microscopes and telescopes, there are whole new worlds being discovered. So if you look through a telescope or a microscope, you see things that no one had ever dreamed of. And if you look at the world around you, people had no idea that laws govern these things. How fast a rock falls, how long a planet takes to make its orbit. All of a sudden, everywhere you looked, there was something astonishing. At a time when no one could answer the simplest question, why do flames burn? Why do rocks fall?
One of your men, I can't remember whether it's Hook or Boyle, had a cure, I believe, for either gout or goiter that involved human excrement. How did that work?
This is a fine illustration of this business of these men being not like us and in being half in a medieval world and half in a new world that they just glimpsed. This is Boyle, who was one of the most esteemed scientists of the day, and yet his life is filled with these bizarre folk remedies. A cure for cataracts was to blow powdered human excrement into the patient's eyes. He had this notion that another one of the most valuable tools in a physician's weapon kit was death sweat, which was if you took the severed hands of a criminal who had been hanged, the sweat on those hands held the power to heal. And Boyle, an absolutely eminent, straight-issue, admirable man, went on at great length about the powers of this death sweat.
And the hands with the death sweat were available at public hangings. I mean, describe Tyburn and how the trophies were sold off.
Hangings in London in the 1600s were a great event. This was there were 8 hanging days a year, public holidays. 20,000 people would gather around. The rich would sit in bleachers. The poor would stand and elbow one another for a better view. No one questioned the propriety of the hangings themselves, but they were already liberals and conservatives. The liberals' notion was that if you had a friend being hanged, it was perfectly all right to run up to him and to yank on his legs to speed up his death. But the conservatives didn't want any part of that. That was much too soft. This was supposed to be a punishment after all. And then the executioner afterwards would auction off souvenirs. He would cut up the death rope into foot-long lengths and auction those. And as I say, these severed hands of the prisoners were especially coveted and valuable because of the death sweat they contained.
But as matters proceed during the second half of the 17th century, the society has a firm belief among most of these people in mathematics. Somehow the world is governed by mathematics. Is that right?
That idea, which was a new idea, comes to take hold. And one of the things that my book is about is that there is this bizarre disjunction between the world looking chaotic and catastrophic when you look out the window and these intellectuals telling you, no, if you only look from the right angle, it all makes perfect sense. What they found, to their astonishment, is that the kind of thing that Euclid had studied as matters for a textbook, that an ellipse was a certain curve or a parabola was a certain curve, that these things applied in the real world, not just in books. If you shoot an arrow, it goes in a parabola. If you trace the path of a planet around the sun, it's an ellipse. It was as if a geometry book had been flung across the heavens. 17th century mathematicians looked at that and they were astonished. And they said, see, it's what we told you all along. God isn't just a creator, he's a mathematician.
The greatest of these geniuses associated with the Royal Society in the beginning is Newton, Isaac Newton, who is a sublime mathematician.
Newton was one of the astonishing figures who ever lived. Even in his day, no one could quite make sense of him, a prickly, cantankerous, solitary character, but undeniably more brilliant than everyone else, and therefore not to be disputed. Newton was born on Christmas Day. His father died a few months before he was born. He took even that birth as a signal that he was separate and set apart and designated by God to be the one to tell the world of God's secrets. Newton saw his mission as decoding the cipher in which God had encoded the world. A crazy notion, except that Newton was so astonishingly successful in his own life that you can almost come to believe that he was singled out.
His great, or maybe his first great invention is calculus. And when does that take place? How old is Newton and what is calculus?
Newton was a young man. He's at Cambridge, a 20-year-old, an undergrad. No one has ever heard of him. They shut down the university because plague has struck London. He goes home to his mother's farm. She wants him to help her with the farm chores. He doesn't give her a moment's notice. He sits down, and on his own, he invents essentially the mathematics that would govern the scientific and technological world for the next 200 years. He invents calculus. And what it is, it's a way of taking a snapshot of the moving world so that you can answer questions about how fast a cannonball is racing across the sky, or where you should aim it to do the most damage at a castle, where will be the peak of an arrow if you shoot it at a certain angle. Any question about motion, calculus was able to answer, and before Newton explained how to do it, no one had known how to do that at all. They could only answer static questions about the area of a circle or the angles of a triangle, that kind of thing. But if you took that circle and turned it into a cannonball and shot the cannonball across the room, before Newton, no one would have known what to do, and after Newton, anyone could answer questions at once and easily.
So Galileo, Kepler are earlier generations when they discover the movement of the planets, but the great 17th century contribution achievement is calculus.
Calculus is the one that lets you talk about motion, which is brand new. What happens is that Galileo and Kepler come along first, as you say, and Kepler has lots to say about the planets in the sky. Galileo has plenty to say about that, and also about what happens on Earth when you drop rocks off the Leaning Tower of Pisa, say. And then Newton comes along and he says these two things, science in the heavens and science on Earth, which look quite different, are actually united. They're both the same, and I can show you that they're the same, even though no one before me had ever suspected such a thing.
And how does that connect with his discovery of gravity?
When Newton watches an apple fall, it's extraordinary that should have been triggered any idea in him at all. Everyone has seen an apple fall, and no one has given it a second thought. Every baby knows if he drops his rattle to look towards the floor. What Newton figured out is that there was something to be asked. It was worth asking, why does that apple fall? And when he explained that, he looked up and he decided that the moon was falling too, even though it doesn't seem to be falling in the least. It seems to be pinned against the sky. But he explained why it was falling, and then he explained that not only is the moon falling, and not only is the apple falling, but they're both falling according to the same law, and that law governs everything in the universe. And he had figured it out. And for that discovery, Newton was worshipped almost as a god.
In your epilogue, you make the distinction between Giordano Bruno in 1600 and Newton in 1705. Make that point as a way of encompassing the discoveries of the 17th century.
What happened in 1600 was that Bruno, who is an Italian philosopher, says that the Earth is one of only infinitely many planets. And for saying that, the Inquisition throws him in a jail cell, then drags him out of the cell, brings him across town, ties him to a stake, sets him on fire, drives a spike through his tongue so he won't utter any final heresies. A century later, Newton is knighted by the Queen of England. When he dies a little while later, dukes and earls carry his casket. He receives what is, in effect, a royal funeral. And what Newton had done, what won him those honors, was essentially to convince the world that what Bruno had been killed for was speaking the truth. So sometime in that century, what would have got you burned alive at one point would get you a king's funeral later on. The vanguard of the modern world changed from Italy, where Bruno was, to England, where Newton was, essentially because the church in Italy decided to set itself up against science, and the church in England figured out that science and religion could be allies, that science could take as its mission to show, to honor God's glory, to explain his handiwork.
The other man in the 17th century who invented calculus was Gottfried Leibniz. Speak something about Leibniz and about the rivalry between Leibniz and Newton as to who had found calculus.
Leibniz is Newton's contemporary, a German philosopher, one of the few people ever so brilliant that Newton himself acknowledged that, wow, here's maybe a peer. But as far as Newton knew, Leibniz had confined himself. Mathematics was only a minor interest. Leibniz was interested in virtually everything else. One of the other great eminent scholars of the day said that just to watch Leibniz and to listen to him expound on everything under the sun made you want to crawl into a corner of the room under your desk and cringe. That was about Leibniz's estimate of his own powers, in fact. He was terribly pleased with himself when young women he knew would get married, his favorite wedding gift was for them was a collection of his own maxims and insights. Perhaps with reason, a genuinely, astonishingly brilliant man. Newton had invented calculus on his own in those years home on his mother's farm, as I say, but hadn't told anyone. Newton had, you could worship Newton, that was fine with him, but he couldn't bear criticism, and so he seldom told anyone what he had found for fear that there might be some sniping from his peers. Leibniz didn't have that in him at all. He was constantly proclaiming whatever idea had occurred to him most recently. So Newton invents calculus and doesn't tell anyone. A couple of decades later, Leibniz invents calculus on his own, not knowing that Newton has done it. But whereas Newton didn't tell anybody, Leibniz takes out ticker tape signs to tell everybody what he's found and how marvelous it is, which infuriates Newton. And then the two of them and their followers for the next two decades fight this pitched battle for who has made the discovery of what everyone sees is the great intellectual triumph of the age.
Newton dies at 84, a virgin, and never having seen the sea, is that correct?
Yes. Newton, one of his great achievements was to explain how the tides work, but no, he never saw the ocean himself. He lived his entire life in a tiny triangle about 100 miles on a side, a solitary, monkish, bad-tempered, eccentric character. Leibniz, on the other hand, was a complete flibbertigibbet. He couldn't have borne to live his life in any kind of tiny confined, constantly running around, talking at the top of his lungs. Leibniz was kind of the smartest boy in fifth grade, grown up, perpetually waving his hand, writing books and letters as he jogs along the back of his horse, always doing a dozen things at once. What Newton did was one thing at a time, but that one thing better than anyone else had ever done anything.
And between them, they brought us the modern world. Thank you, Edward Dolnick, for speaking with us today about the invention of modern science. I'm Lewis Lapham of Lapham's Quarterly for Bloomberg News, copyright Bloomberg 2011.